Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Who is Joy Williams and what makes her a great American writer? A.O. Scott will be here to talk about the author and her work. What does the future look like for the coronavirus? Nicholas Christakis will be here to talk about his new book, Apollo's Arrow. Alexander Alter will have an update from the publishing world. Plus, we'll talk about what we and the wider world are reading. This is the Book Review Podcast from the New York Times. It's November 20th. I'm Pamela Paul. A.O. Scott joins us now to talk about the latest in his series of essays, The Americans. Tony, thanks for being here.
It's great to be here.
This time around, you write about Joy Williams. For those who are not familiar with her work, who is Joy Williams?
Joy Williams is an American novelist and short story writer. She's still alive. She's in her 70s. She started publishing in the 1970s. Her first novel was State of Grace. And she's had kind of a loyal cult following. In a profile of her a few years ago in the New York Times Magazine, Dan Coyce referred to her as a writer's writer's writer.
I was going to bring that up.
Yeah, which I think is a great phrase because she has a very passionate following. If you look at paperback editions of her books, you see a collection of big names, Don DeLillo, Harold Brodkey, James Salter, all praising her. One of the things I discovered and actually wrote about in this essay is that she's a very difficult writer to pigeonhole or to classify. And I came into this piece, to doing the reading for it, thinking of her one way based on the reading that I'd done of some of her earlier novels and stories, and ended up with a different idea of her. I started out thinking of her as kind of a realist, almost in the sort of Raymond Carver or Anne Beattie vein, very close-grained, finely detailed, reticent realism. And ended up thinking of her as something almost completely different, sort of a fabulist, a surrealist, an almost magical or witchy kind of writer.
Okay, I'm going to ask you all kinds of questions that I think you don't want to be asked to try to pin her down, because there's a lot in here. I want to actually go first back to that original phrase you used, writer's writer's writer. But actually, let's just simplify it to a writer's writer, because I think that is the kind of phrase that people use that to people who are writers maybe mean something, but that is kind of mysterious to non-writers. What do we mean when we use that phrase?
I've never really understood the phrase or particularly.
Oh my God,
liked
you heard it.
It
here first.
Yes. And I mean, I think what it means is that if you think that writers read differently from the rest of us and are maybe more attuned to certain matters of craft and technique that the rest of us rush over, let's say, you know, this is a caricature, but most people, we read for the plot, we read for the characters, we read for the emotions. And maybe writers are looking at something different. They're looking at the brushstrokes, so to speak, at the sentences, at the rhythm.
Right, on the sentence level, as one says.
The sentence level. And I'm not sure that's true, but it is true that within any profession, there are people, you know, it's true of stand-up comedians or actors or filmmakers, that there are some who have a special kind of respect from their peers that may be disproportionate to their renown or popularity or fame or acclaim out in the world. Now, I mean, Joy Williams has won and been nominated for all of the major awards, and she's very well reviewed, and her books, you know, stay in print. So she has certainly a loyal readership that isn't just writers. But I think there's something special about her, and I think it has to do with her resistance to classification in a way, that she's writing sentences and stories and characters and plots that are so unusual and that seemed to result from a kind of total inventiveness. I feel like having read just about all of the fiction that she's published in the last few months, I can say that I feel like there's a kind of attention to words and sentences and developments within the story and the plot that keep you on the edge of your seat and at the edge of your attention throughout. There are writers where you can kind of let your mind wander a little bit and coast a little bit in the, okay, I know this passage of description is going to tell me something about the house, or this, okay, these people are having this conversation now. And you can sort of skate over it. And you can't do that in a Joy Williams story. You have to be paying attention at every moment because the terms of the fiction, what the characters are thinking and feeling, how they're relating to each other, what is going to happen in the language from one sentence to the next, whether it's going to be sad or mysterious or funny, is going to change. So you just have to keep your eyes on the road and your hand on the wheel the whole time.
All right, I want to bring this down to earth and talk about some of the stories and novels themselves to kind of give people a sense of, like, what are these books and story collections about? How do they read? And let's start with the novels. Even though I think many people reading today probably think of her mostly as a short fiction writer, since her last novel, The Quick and the Dead, was in 2001. What would you say about the four novels?
They're about young women. All of them. They are State of Grace, The Changeling, Breaking and Entering, and The Quick and the Dead. And they're about young women who are in some way kind of adrift and not entirely in control of their circumstances and to some extent kind of at the mercy of men and marriage and children, but also in a kind of mysterious relationship to their own desires and their own lives. So they're at once very passive and very powerful. The Changeling is the most extreme and anti-realistic of her novels. It reads almost like a fairy tale about a woman who gets married and has a child and goes to live on a strange island that's run by her brother-in-law, who is doing all of these psychological experiments on young children. And then it goes in very dark and strange and mysterious places without ever quite leaving the modern reality of, you know, of the world that we recognize. Similarly, in Breaking and Entering, the young woman named Liberty is living in South Florida, drifting around with her husband and their dog, occupying other people's houses, sort of moving into abandoned or empty vacation homes, kind of like hermit crabs. And it's about her dissatisfaction and her paralysis and her trying to kind of get control of her own life, her own feelings, her own circumstances. And the thing about these books is they're very psychologically intense in a way, and they're also very funny and full of barbed jokes about sex, about love, about wildlife, about children, about home furnishings. So they function both at various registers of realism and also seem completely concocted in a kind of almost fantastical way.
You know, you've mentioned Florida a couple of times now, and I tend to think of her as a Florida writer, probably mostly because I think she spends most, if not a good chunk of her time in Key West. And I think I was actually supposed to be at a literary festival with her in the before times in Key West. Who knows when that'll happen? But she doesn't stick to one region of the country, right? She spends her time, I think, in Arizona as well. And she writes about various parts of the country. Like, do you think of her as of a certain region?
Well, at first I did. When I started this project and I had read a lot of the short stories and I had read Breaking and Entering and sort of wanted to find out more, I sort of thought of her as a Florida writer. And the recent edition of The Changeling, her novel from 1978, has a wonderful introduction by the Florida novelist Karen Russell. And so I sort of thought of her as that kind of slightly comical, slightly grotesque, trashy, funny, vivid Florida literary world that, you know, you think of maybe Harry Cruz or Carl Hyson, or there is a whole Florida thing in American literature. But she also writes about Arizona, about Maine, and she writes about these American places that are somehow both specific and generic. So they're suburbs or small towns, and there are, you know, strip malls and bars and a lot of familiar, you might say, sort of Carver-esque scenery that it could be anywhere in America. But they're also, she's very attentive to landscape and to wildlife and to just the strangeness of everything. I feel like the thing about her as a writer is that she takes nothing for granted. She defamiliarizes everything. So you might think, you know, in a short story, oh, this takes place in New England in the winter in Maine, which is another state that she's lived in. But it doesn't conform to any of your preconceived ideas about what that place and what that setting might be like. And I think the same is true of The Quick and the Dead, which takes place in Arizona. It's not Barbara Kingsolver's Arizona. It's not the Southwest as we have thought about it through travel or through other reading. So every place that she comes to, it's as if you're there for the first time and everything has to be described to you and conveyed to you in the most immediate and vivid and specific terms because you've sort of dropped in from another planet and you need to get your bearings.
The reason we're talking about Joy Williams right now is not because she's published anything new. I think her last collection was in...
It was 3 or 4 years ago. It was a collection of short stories with new and selected work. Although she did just publish a short story just a few weeks ago in The New Yorker. So she's still going. But these essays, and this is the third one, what I love about them is that I can write about writers who don't have anything new, who don't have any any other sort of immediate claim on our attention and whose publicists we haven't been hearing from.
It is the third in a series. The first was, of course, Wallace Stegner. The second was Edward P. Jones. For people who didn't catch our conversations about those writers or the essays themselves, can you talk again a little bit about what exactly this is and how you're choosing the writers to write about?
Well, I had this idea. We had this idea for a series of essays about American writers who capture something about the imaginative and cultural and real life of this country that isn't easily encapsulated in the kind of political and sociological language that we tend to talk about America in, especially in this election year. So that don't necessarily fit ideological or regional or race or gender or identity categories that we tend to sort each other and ourselves into, that just kind of offer a more expansive and just a different way of looking at our common experience. And so Wallace Stegner, you know, is a great Western writer, but it turns out that his idea of the West is different from how we tend to think about it from Western movies or from political discourse. Edward P. Jones is a Black writer, a Washington, D.C. writer, in some ways a Southern writer, both a realist and kind of a magic realist, and just a really extraordinary imaginer of realities of American life that are often either overlooked or reduced to symbols or cliches or social problems. Joy Williams is kind of a wild card. You know, she's not a regional writer, but her writing takes place very far away from the literary centers of gravity in the United States. I think she's a feminist writer, but her female protagonists are, you know, not necessarily the sort of the icons of strong womanhood or female victimhood that you might expect from that designation. She's a comic writer. She's in some ways a fantastical, magical writer. One of the things that I found most interesting about her is that you can place her in all kinds of different company and her writing and the writing that she's next to changes. So I started out, as I write in the piece, thinking of her, you know, alongside Anne Beattie and Raymond Carver and the kind of the, what used to be called the dirty realists of the 1970s and 80s. I ended up thinking about her more in belonging with, you know, with Nathaniel Hawthorne or Kate Chopin or Charlotte Perkins Gilman. So she always seems to be moving both in the literal geography of the United States, writing about the West, about New England, about Florida, but also in the imaginative or literary geography of the United States. So she's maybe not just a writer's writer's writer, but like an American's American's American writer.
When did you first read Joy Williams and what did you start with?
I first read Joy Williams when I was in college in the 1980s. And the first book I read was Breaking and Entering. And it was part of this series, which still exists, the Vintage Contemporaries paperback imprint, which was a very particular thing in the 1980s. You know,
oh, I remember it well. Covers, tell us. Yeah,
the covers were these very distinctive kind of white and pastel, vividly illustrated. It's just a very 80s kind of thing.
There was like this like confetti, like weird colorful shapes sometimes on the covers,
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly. And who knows what this is? You know, you look at this book and it's kind of a puzzle in the cover. And then inside the puzzle continues. And it's a very funny and strange and sad book that's really just dominated by the voice and the perspective of this young woman, Liberty, who's just sort of drifting through this landscape, meeting all of these odd characters in the company of her dog and just trying to figure out what her life is going to be. And I read it, and it was at the time like nothing else I'd ever read. And I read some of her short stories after that. And when the time came to kind of pick the next subject for these, for this series of essays, I thought, well, what about that? You know, because I sort of felt like I'd started with her and then wanted to follow up, you know, wanted to see what else was there.
Well, I hope I've piqued interest among our listeners. To the uninitiated, where would you suggest a reader start?
I think the short stories collected in The Visiting Privilege, because it surveys her career and selects from the earlier volumes of stories. And you can really get a sense of her range and her voice and just the different flavors, the funny, the sad, the surreal, the mysterious, the disturbing aspects of her imagination, if you just kind of dive in and read a bunch of those stories. And then if you're anything like me, you won't want to stop. I mean, there's something very addictive about the way that she writes. And it has to do, I think, with that aliveness and vividness of her language and the strangeness of her plotting and her stories. I mean, she starts out always in one place, and every time you think you know where a story is going, it swerves in another direction. And there's just a kind of rush and intrigue in that you just want to kind of keep on rediscovering and keep finding.
All right. Well, we will start there, and then we will look forward to the fourth in the series. Tony, always a pleasure to have you.
Great talking with you, Pamela. Take care.
A.O. Scott is a critic at large for the New York Times, and he is writing a series of essays for the Book Review called The Americans.
Come and Get It is the highly anticipated new novel from New York Times bestselling and award-winning author Kylie Reid. A fresh and provocative story about a college RA and her messy entanglement with a professor and three unruly students. Come and Get It is an intimate portrait of consumption, desire, and reckless abandon. Look for Come and Get It, available from Putnam, wherever books are sold.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments. Ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
Regular listeners of the podcast will know that we're getting close to that time of year when we announce our 10 best books, which is a very exciting time. You'll be able to hear it, of course, on the podcast next week, November 27th. But if you want to hear it earlier and live, as in Zoom Live, you can sign up for a virtual event that will be held on November 23rd for New York Times subscribers. If you'd like to be there, albeit virtually, go to timesevents.nytimes.com to RSVP. My colleagues and I will be doing our usual thing, talking about the books that made the list, as well as getting a chance to wax rhapsodic about our personal favorites that didn't quite make the cut. This is one of our favorite podcasts and events of the year, so look forward to seeing you there. Nicholas Christakis is a physician and a sociologist and an epidemiologist who directs the Human Nature Lab at Yale University. His new book is called Apollo's Arrow, The Profound and Enduring Impact of Coronavirus on the Way We Live. And he joins us now from Vermont. Hi, Nicholas.
Hi, Pamela. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. This is a timely book. It's completely of the moment and on the moment. When did you decide to write this? And how fast did you have to do it?
I decided to write the book in the middle of March, and I worked 12 hours a day for 120 days in a row and delivered the manuscript, I was very proud, on schedule to Little Brown Spark, whenever that is. So April, May, June, and July as promised. And then, of course, they had to edit it and produce it.
Is this the first time you've done that? Like, you've done a complete speed book?
God, yes. I mean, usually the kinds of things that I write take much longer. My prior book was Blueprint, The Evolutionary Origins of a Good Society. And I think that I worked on that for nine years. So
right.
my editor is joking that I'm averaging down, you know, to a quicker pace. But yes, but I think this book, I was really powerfully motivated. I really wanted to write this book. It just sort of poured out of me. And also, I wanted to help, you know, I wanted to help the public understand the nature of the threat we are facing and the ways in which this threat is both timeless and novel. And so I knew most of the things I needed to know to write the book. So unlike some of the other stuff, I didn't need to start from scratch. I could just write. And so it was honestly a wonderful experience.
We've basically all been hoovering up news about coronavirus online in one way or another. But what can you get from a book like this that you might not be able to get from, say, you know, scanning constantly the headlines in The Atlantic or The New York Times and elsewhere?
Well, what I've tried to do in the book is to try to provide kind of deftly a tutorial about epidemiology by using powerful and interesting stories. So I talk about how epidemics have had particular effects on human society for thousands of years. And I use examples from the bubonic plague or from the 1918 pandemic or from the 2003 SARS pandemic. And I try to bring vivid stories about all of these types of events. And then also kind of along the way, help the reader understand some fundamentals about how contagious disease works. And then I try to sort of tie it all together so that the reader can position what's happening to them in their own lives and what's happening to our society in broader principles of epidemiology and the history of infectious disease. So unlike the daily news blips that you might get, this book, I think, provides a deep and a broad and I hope vivid and engaging narrative about what's happening.
So you mentioned a bunch of different pandemics from eras past and close to our own. And I think each of us probably has one that we tend to focus on, whether it's, you know, for me, it's the 1918 flu, probably for literary reasons, because there's a lot of good books, or maybe the Black Plague, the Black Death, because there's some good books out of that. But for others, it's Ebola, or they just don't understand how it's different from the flu. What makes the coronavirus different? If you kind of had to boil it down from other major viruses that we've typically encountered.
Well, first of all, I want to highlight the difference between viral pathogens and bacterial pathogens. So, you know, with bacteria, we have lots of antibiotics and classes of antibiotics. But with viruses, we still are very weak in medicine in treating viral diseases. So it's bad news that this is a virus. This is a virus like smallpox is a virus or measles is a virus, for example. Bubonic plague, of course, was a bacteria. And now you can just treat that with the tetracycline that you can get in any pharmacy. But the thing to understand about this pandemic in particular is that in some ways we are very lucky that it's not much deadlier. Bubonic plague could kill 50% of the people in a population, or in some villages in Italy, 90%. Smallpox would wipe out Native American populations. 95% of the people would die over a span of a number of months or years. So this disease, bad as it is, we're so lucky it's not much worse because it could have been. For example, certain other coronaviruses that have come out in the last 20 years, like SARS in 2003, SARS-1, which was a coronavirus, killed about 10% of the people that it infects. And this particular pathogen kills about 1% of the people that it infects. So on the one hand, we should be really lucky it's not much worse, because it could have been. And the 1918 pandemic was also worse in terms of how deadly it was. So on the one hand, I'm starting with the good news, seemingly. Like, how can I say, oh my God, you know, this is terrific news. The pathogen only kills 1% of people. Of course, when you take the long sweep of things, you can see why that's good. On the other hand, this is actually a serious pathogen. 1% of people dying is really very deadly. And so it's 10 times deadlier than the flu. It's not a trivial disease at all. And we are rightly taking it incredibly seriously. I think ultimately, probably 40% of Americans will wind up being infected with this pathogen. Although if we get quickly to a vaccine, we might bring that number down. And if that happens, we have 330 million Americans. You know, 40% of that is about 130 million Americans. And if 1% of those people die, we could have as many as 1 million deaths in our society. I'm pretty sure we will surpass 500,000 deaths. So this is a devastating thing that has happened. And I guess one of the things I'd like to emphasize is that the world has changed. Whether we want to accept it or not, it has changed. A new pathogen has been introduced into our midst. And we just have to maturely and resolutely accept this new reality. And we as a society and as a world are going to be called upon to make sacrifices and to tolerate tremendous discomfort. And I guess I would say that in some ways we should ask ourselves, why should we think we are any different than any other group of people that have lived for the last few thousand years? Plagues have always been a part of the human experience. They're just new to us.
Right, right. We thought we were done with that.
Yes. We thought we were done, or we thought, oh, we're 21st century Americans. We're a rich, modern, urban society. We have science. We have modern science and modern medicine. How can this be? But it is. You know, this has always been a feature of human experience. And now it's rare. I mean, these types of serious global pandemics occur every 50 or 100 years. And if you look across the sweep of things, you can see that this pandemic is going to wind up being probably the second worst respiratory pandemic we've had in 100 years, surpassing the 1957 pandemic, which also began in China, and approximating the 1918 pandemic, which some people speculate began in the United States, actually.
You bring up the psychology of people dealing with this disease and also some interesting sociological questions. And given that you're a sociologist as well, it feels like a good moment to ask, is this behavior that we're having, I mean, it reminds me a little bit of The Mask of the Red Death, the Edgar Allan Poe short story, where people are sort of constantly saying, well, it's not going to be us, it's going to be them, because they're the most vulnerable. Oh, no, it turns out that it can get some children, so maybe they're the most vulnerable. And I'm curious if this kind of behavioral aspect of people kind of figuring out who are the ones who are spreading it, who are the ones who are vulnerable, and political and sociological behavior is kind of resulting. I mean, did this happen in 1918, for example? Did people say, oh, it's their problem, not ours?
Yeah. I mean, the fact that it was called the Spanish flu, for example, you know, was trying to blame it on Spain, although there's an interesting historical reason for why it was called the Spanish flu. It was just that everywhere else in the world, because they were at war, they were suppressing information, but the flu reports were coming out of Spain. So people thought, oh, that's where it's coming from. No, I think you're highlighting the many ways in which plagues or epidemics like this are not only biological, but also social and psychological phenomena. And one of the ways are social is this impetus to blame. So, for example, the ancient Greeks in the plague of Athens in 430 BC wanted to blame outsiders. During the bubonic plagues in Europe, anti-Semitism was at an enormous high, and the Jews were blamed and often drawn and quartered or burned. There were some cities in which thousands of Jews were buried alive. When it comes to syphilis epidemics in Europe, it was called the French pox if you were a Spaniard, or the Spanish pox if you were a Frenchman. During the HIV epidemic in our country, there was this effort to demonize and blame gay people or Haitians or IV drug users and so on. And now we see it with this desire, you know, to blame the Chinese. And there are a lot of reasons why people do this. One of the reasons is, of course, by blaming other people, we can kind of pretend that, oh, you know, we're not responsible. But also, there's a sense in which by blaming humans, you make the threat in a way less frightening, because it's much more frightening to imagine that, you know, God is punishing us, or that there's some kind of implacable working of nature. Whereas if you can imagine, oh, it's just some human beings that have brought it into our country, let's just find them and get rid of them, and then the problem will go away.
You come to this as both a medical doctor and as a sociologist. And I'm curious if those perspectives ever clash when you're trying to explain this virus and the way it's played out.
Honestly, no. I think Virchow, a famous physician from previous centuries, said that nothing human is alien to a doctor, something like that. I'm butchering the saying. But honestly, there's something very intimate and humane and human about being a physician, at least to my eye. And that's one of the reasons that I was so pleased to have had the opportunity to train as a doctor. And, you know, I practiced hospice medicine for many years. I took care of seriously ill people who were dying, which is another privilege. But if you take the broad view of medicine, it is inescapable the extent to which social factors influence people's risk of getting ill and people's experience of illness. And I was trained as well by medical historians and medical anthropologists and medical sociologists. In fact, I dedicate my book to Renee Fox, a woman who just died. Actually, she knew that I had dedicated the book to her, but she just died a couple of weeks ago at the age of 92. She was one of my advisors. But anyway, so no, I honestly, at least in me, I don't sense a tension between medicine and social science when it comes to understanding the human predicament.
As a sociologist, you specialize in theory around social networks. And one thing I think that continues to confuse people is the extent to which the spread of this virus is social and behavioral, you know, whether it's about masks and social distancing, and to the extent that it's just purely about the virus and the nature of its contagiousness and its ability to mutate and thrive. Can you kind of clarify that as you see it?
So first of all, I think the epidemiological and biological on the one hand and the social and the psychological on the other hand come together and fuse when it comes to epidemic disease. So on the one hand, one has to understand some basic ideas about the contagiousness of a pathogen. And this particular pathogen, earlier we spoke about its lethality, about how, you know, it was neither horrifically deadly like bubonic plague, nor, you know, benign, or not benign, but relatively not so worrisome like the flu, that it was sort of in between in terms of its lethality. Now we can speak a little bit about its intrinsic contagiousness. And here too, it's sort of in between. On the one hand, you have diseases like measles, which have something called an R-naught, which is the basic reproduction number, which is the number of new cases you get for each existing case in a non-immune, naturally interacting host population. For measles, that number is 18. That means each measles case creates 18 new measles cases. That's really infectious. For the seasonal flu, that number is about 1.5. So each infected person creates 1.5 new people. For the coronavirus that we're facing, that number is probably about 3. And that's quite infectious, actually. So on the one hand, we have to understand that, like there's this intrinsic property of the germ that makes it reasonably spreadable. But on the other hand, we have to look at human behavior. Some people are very popular and they hug and they touch other people as well. Some people are not. Some people are hermits. You know, if you're a hermit or if you're a misanthrope, now's your time to shine, actually, during an epidemic, because you're lower risk of contagion. As some people wear masks, some people are better able to engage in physical distancing practices. And so all of these behaviors that we manifest can interact with the germ and affect its flow through social networks. Let me give you one idea that might interest you. Early on, it was observed that politicians and famous actors were more likely to get this condition. And many people thought, well, that's just because we're hearing about them. You know, those people are famous, and that's why we read about, you know, Tom Hanks or Boris Johnson, for example. But it's not just that. It's that these people are actually more popular. They have more social interactions. They are more in the middle of a social network. So as this germ is using our social connections as a kind of highway to travel through the human population, it's more likely to reach these popular people early in the course of the epidemic. This happens all the time. But the interesting thing about this is that those popular people are also intrinsically a kind of super spreader as well. The germ reaches them sooner, and once it reaches them, they spread it to more people. And so this furthermore means that if these people become immune because they've been exposed, they will cut down on paths through the social network for the germ to spread. So the more rapidly popular people in the middle of a social network either acquire immunity naturally or are vaccinated, the more rapidly the epidemic will come to an end. So you could make the argument that when we have a vaccine available, we should be targeting it at people with many social interactions rather than at people at greatest risk of death.
That's a very politically volatile issue right now.
Yeah, it is. And this is, again, goes back. So that's right. So in other words, you could either go out to pick to whom to give the vaccine based on their individual level risk for dying. For example, whether they have diabetes or some other chronic disease, or if they have an ethno-racial background, for instance, that for some reason places them at greater risk because of occupational factors or because of their chronic illnesses. Or you could look at the elderly, for example, would be another very logical group of people. They're at substantially higher risk of dying. So one strategy is you say, we're going to give the vaccine to people at greatest risk of death. And that is the moral thing to do and makes a lot of sense from the individual level perspective. But from the collective perspective, this might be the least wise thing to do because the elderly, for example, are at the end of transmission chains. If you want to really stop the epidemic from spreading and potentially save more lives, you actually might want to vaccinate working age people, even though they are themselves as individuals at lower risk of death. This is, first of all, from a mathematical conceptual point of view, quite a difficult thing to work out, like how to do it. But it also highlights another thing we're talking about, which is the ways in which we have fallen down as a nation on straight talk about this epidemic. Our leaders have not been honest and forthright with us about the nature of the threat that we are facing and the sacrifices we will have to make. Because if you were going to try to do something as unpopular as vaccinating the people at lowest risk of death because they're at the highest risk of transmission, you have to be able to educate the public to understand why you're doing that and why it's in everyone's interests and why collectively banding together to confront this threat is so important. It's sort of like you send young people to be in the army, even though they have the most life left to live.
You know, it's interesting that you're bringing up phrases like social network and words like popularity, because those are terms that have, even before the coronavirus sent us all into quarantine and more deeply into our computers, those are terms that nowadays people think of as more online phenomena than they do in real life. When you say the word social network, people's first thought is probably Facebook before it is hanging out at parties and going to corporate networking events, that kind of thing.
But the irony, of course, is that we human beings have been making face-to-face social networks for tens of thousands of years. And so the kinds of networks I'm most interested in are the real face-to-face social networks. So these are ornate, beautiful things that we assemble ourselves into and that natural selection has shaped us to make. These networks that we make are like the human equivalent of ant colonies. We can't but make them, and we can only make a specific kind of social network, and we can no more deviate from that than that an ant can wake up in the morning and make a beehive.
So how do you explain a purely an in-person social network event, like a super spreader event? People don't really understand, how does that work? What happened at that White House lawn ceremony, for example?
Well, there's both a biology and a sociology of it. So one of the biological features that's subtle but very important is earlier we talked about how the R-naught, the basic reproduction number of this virus, is about 3. But that doesn't mean that every single person transmits the virus to 3 people. So imagine 2 different situations. In one situation, you have 100 people, and every one of them can transmit it to 3 people. So if one of them moves to another part of the country, they'll start a new epidemic over in that spot. In another situation, you have 100 people. One of them can transmit it to 300 other people. They're a super spreader. And the other 99 are dead ends. They transmit it to no one. And I talk about this in the book, of course. So in that situation, if one of the 100 people goes to another part of the country, 99 out of 100 times, there'll be no new epidemic. So this is called the dispersion parameter, the variation in how transmissible the disease is. Ironically, the more dispersion, the more the propensity of the virus to have a super spreader event, like the latter case I discussed, where one person can spread it to 300 and the 99 spread it to no one, paradoxically, the easier it is to control the epidemic. And the intuition should be that in the former case, where you have 100 people that spread it every one to 3 people, that sets up very reliable transmission chains, right? Like one of those people will go somewhere else, they'll infect 3 other people, and each of those people will infect 3 people, and on and on and on it'll go. Whereas in the high dispersion case, most of the time when someone goes from one place to another, no new epidemic is started. So this virus, this coronavirus, has a capacity for super spreading that is, on the one hand, worrisome because you get these super spreading events. On the other hand, actually good for us because the transmission chains are less reliably set up. In the White House, what happened was, in fact, a super spreading event. And that had to do with certain social practices and frankly, the lack of implementation of mask wearing and physical distancing and other things that they should have been doing.
All right. I have a last question for you. People who listen to this podcast know that I don't like plot spoilers and I don't like to give away endings, but your last chapter is called How Plagues End. So I have to ask you, how do they end?
Well, they it's very difficult to tell that quickly, but let me instead...
Give us a taste and okay. Then everyone else can read the ending of the
book. Okay. Well, when you think about how plagues end, you can sort of think about how they might end biologically or how they might end sociologically, for example. On the biological front, in turn, there are a number of ways they could end as well. One is by reaching something known as herd immunity. When enough people have been infected and become immune, the pathogen has a much harder time then circulating through the population. Or the pathogen can evolve to be more benign. From the point of view of the germ, it doesn't really want to kill us. It would rather have us sort of be, you know, ambulatory, you know, like be sick, but able to move around and survive enough to spread it to other people. And that's another potential way the pathogen might end. But the pathogens can also end sociologically. And in some sense, this happens when we come to accept the pathogen and what's happening. I think in the case of coronavirus, there's going to be three periods. We are not yet at the beginning of the end of this epidemic. I think we are just at the end of the beginning. We are still in the opening act of the coronavirus pandemic of 2019. And what's going to happen over the next year and a half is either we will invent a vaccine, which I think is likely in 2021, but then it'll take about a year to manufacture, distribute, and have everyone get the vaccine, which takes us to 2022. And meanwhile, the germ is spreading, so we will probably reach herd immunity naturally by 2022. So either way, we have another year and a half or so before we get to the first phase of the epidemic being behind us. Either way, we get to 2022 before we have sort of dealt with the biological and epidemiological impact of the pathogen. But then, even after we've faced that problem, we now have to recover from the psychological, social, and economic shock. And, you know, it's not like suddenly everyone's going to go back to the airport or go back to restaurants. It's going to take a while for our economy to recover. And looking at historical plagues, that typically has taken a couple of years. So that gets us to 2024. And then in 2024, I think we're going to have the post-pandemic period, which might well be like the roaring 20s. People will relentlessly seek social interactions. They'll engage in risky behaviors. There'll be a lot of free spending. And it'll be a kind of a return to normal life.
God, this is like the endless ending. It's like the disease equivalent of the last installment of Lord of the Rings. I hope it ends more quickly than that, but we have to end here. Nicholas, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, Pamela.
Nicholas Christakis' new book is called Apollo's Arrow, The Profound and Enduring Impact of Coronavirus on the Way We Live. Alexandra Alter joins us now with some big news from the publishing world. Alexandra, tell us.
So this is one of the biggest weeks in literary award season, and it just so happened that the Booker Prize moved into this week as well. So we had the National Book Awards and the Booker this week. Both were held virtually, of course, because of the coronavirus pandemic. And while I kind of miss going to the National Book Awards at Cipriani and seeing all the authors and seeing everyone all dolled up, it was actually pretty moving to join online, to feel like the literary community was coming together as much as they could, and to see people from all over the country and all over the world leaving comments on YouTube, like, you know, heart emojis and saying that they loved the host Jason Reynolds' jacket, you know, and you saw people from Nigeria and Mexico and Japan. Given the challenges of putting on an awards program in 2020, it was a very moving, I thought, ceremony. And so there were some surprises and nothing too controversial. I think, as I noted on Twitter, the only controversial thing was that Charles Yu, who won for his novel Interior Chinatown, he won the fiction award. He was at home when he accepted the award and he color codes his bookshelf. So they were all, his books are organized by color, which is always causes a lot of debate on Twitter. But I think, you know, it was a lovely evening. So Charles Yu won. And then for the nonfiction prize, this was a really, I thought, moving acceptance speech. Tamara Paine won for the Malcolm X biography that she researched and wrote with her father, Les Paine, and it's called The Dead Are Arising. And it was a very moving acceptance speech because her father passed away a few years ago. And so she really took the project over the finish line. And this was a really heavily researched biography that was decades in the making. And so in her speech, you know, she really lamented the fact that her father couldn't be there to accept it with her, but also expressed her gratitude that, I think she said, he brought me on as his co-pilot. So that was very sweet. The other, I thought, lovely moment was when the translation award was given to Yu Miri for her novel Tokyo Wenno Station. And her translator, Morgan Giles, was on with her. And they were sort of high-fiving the air, kind of trying to celebrate together, even though they were so far apart physically. It was very exciting to see that work recognized. And I love the translation award, which was just added a couple of years ago, but it really, I think, opened the horizons of the prize and has brought a lot of attention to works from other countries that might otherwise be overlooked in this country. The Poetry Award went to Dami Che for her collection, DMZ Colony, and she gave a lovely speech. Poetry is also, I think, always one of the most meaningful awards because, again, these are books that aren't huge blockbusters often. And I think getting a prize can really alter the course of, you know, a poet's career. And the award for young people's literature went to Case and Callender's King and the Dragonflies. So it was a great, I thought, moment for the literary community to kind of celebrate some of these books that didn't get a ton of attention this year. As I've often brought up in conversations with you, the industry is doing well, you know, from a numbers perspective, but the gains have really been skewed toward big publishing houses and big blockbuster authors. And so when you have an awards ceremony like this and more attention goes to books from academic presses and independent presses and works in translation and debut authors, it really does make a difference for those individuals and for those companies. So I feel like this year we really, really needed that spotlight.
But that is not all this week. We also have another big award.
A huge one, the Booker, yes, which also was virtual due to the pandemic and had, I thought, a pretty exciting lineup of speakers, including former President Barack Obama, who has been busily promoting his own memoir this week. He made an appearance at the Booker's online ceremony. So the winner this year is Douglas Stewart for his debut novel, Shuggie Bain, which I think was probably heavily favored to win. It got tremendous reviews. It is a semi-autobiographical novel about his childhood growing up in Glasgow as the son of a single alcoholic mother, and he is sort of learning about his sexuality and feels like an outsider. Margaret Busby, who's the chair of the judges this year, said in her citation that Shuggie Bain is destined to be a classic. It's moving, immersive, and it's a nuanced portrait of a tight-knit social world, its people and its values. And in a press conference, she spoke about how, you know, the judges, you know, they had six finalists and they were rooting for a lot of them, but it was actually a pretty quick and unanimous decision, which is pretty unusual. Last year, they ended up choosing two novelists and throwing out their own rules because they wanted to give it to both Bernardine Evaristo and Margaret Atwood. So this year to have a unanimous decision, I thought was a pretty strong statement. The other Booker finalists were Brandon Taylor for his novel Real Life, also a debut, Diane Cook's novel The New Wilderness, and Avni Doshi's Burnt Sugar. And those were all the debuts. And the established authors on the list were Maza Mengeste for her novel The Shadow King, which is set during Italy's invasion of Ethiopia in the 1930s, and Tsitsi Dangarembga for This Mournable Body, which centers on an out-of-work middle-aged woman in Harare and is sort of a sequel in a way to her debut novel. So as we've seen in previous years, Americans continue to dominate the shortlist as they have really since the Booker Committee changed its rules to open up the prize to any novel written in English and published in the UK. So this year, all but one of the finalists are either American or have dual American citizenship. So that was interesting. And that's been controversial in the past, but I feel like people have pretty much gotten used to it.
Okay, well, lots to celebrate this week in the book world. Alexandra, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Joining us now to talk about what we're reading, my colleagues Tina Jordan and John Williams. Hey, guys.
Hey, Pamela.
Hi, guys.
Tina, let's start with you. What did you read this week?
Well, I haven't finished it, but I'm about halfway through a book called The Element of Lavishness. That's the collected letters of Sylvia Townsend Warner and William Maxwell. Longtime podcast listeners will know that I was on about a year ago on this segment about what I was reading, talking about a Sylvia Townsend Warner novel called The Corner That Held Them, which was a novel I'd never read, never heard of. It was reissued by the New York Review of Books. It was written in the 1940s, and it was about daily life at this 14th century Benedictine nunnery. And it was the kind of book, I think I said, where nothing happened and where everything happened, where you were just like immersed in this tiny community of bickering, petty, funny, loving, badly behaved women. And meanwhile, like, history was unfolding all around them. And I sort of feel the same way about this collection of letters, even though I'm only partway through it. Maxwell was an editor at The New Yorker when they began to write. And these letters, they wrote 1,300 letters. Can you imagine? Like, so they wrote 1,300 letters between 1938 and 1978. And they start out and they're very formal, you know, Mr. Maxwell, you know, Miss Warner. But only a few letters in, they're familiar with one another. And it's not just that they're talking about writing, which is great, but it's also the details of their lives. So the war is raging soon after they start writing. And she sends him a letter saying, "Oh, I'm sorry for this paper." It seems like she might have been writing around the margins of another letter. There was a paper shortage. He sends her a ream of paper. You know, post-war, she will never admit that there's a shortage of anything, but it's so clear from the letters that the New Yorker just kept sending her things, like huge hams, like reams of butter. She denies that there's ever a problem, but she's so grateful for this stuff when it arrives. And so he's sending her food. I mean, he's keeping her family fed, but he's also inquiring about her writing in almost every letter. And they're workshopping with one another. And there's at one point where he says to her, this is actually 1953, he finds out that she doesn't keep carbons of her stories. And he says, "I implore you to change your ways." And he tells a story of an editor who actually lost a story or a chapter in a novel. And she promises to reform. They meet, you know, she comes to New York. Like, these letters, though, because they're both such great writers, this is not a pen pal correspondence like any of us would have. You're just reading about their lives in this amazing prose. And like I said, trading manuscripts, trading stories, getting feedback on writing, but also talking. They're sick. Like, they both, I think, were slight hypochondriacs. And she believed in homeopathic remedies and was always telling him, you know, to eat goose grease and drink raspberry leaf tea and I don't know what all. It's like their whole lives are distilled in these letters, and I just love it.
Goose grease.
First of all, I want to borrow that book ASAP, Tina. But also, I have to read aloud from an appreciation that ran in the book review shortly after Maxwell died. And it's a kind of poignant thing, I think, to read right now, because it was written by Daniel Menaker, who, John, I believe he was a mentor of yours.
Yeah, he was a pal of mine in my early days in publishing.
And someone I knew as well, who also just recently died. But he wrote this really lovely essay for the book review on the last page about Maxwell. And I just want to quote this one graph. "In his conversation and his actions, Maxwell embodied this tension between civilization and its discontents, between the longing for a rational and cultured life and the bad luck and regrets and emotional anarchy that sabotage it. During those high-toned dinner conversations, when something difficult or bitter came up, as it sometimes did, you could feel both Maxwell and his wife not only accepting its arrival, but almost welcoming it. In a letter to me, he wrote, 'Bad behavior one never really regrets in any serious way.'"
I forgot to mention, and I should have, that the very reason I picked up this book was when I talked on the podcast about The Corner That Held Them. Somebody read that book, one of our listeners, and then began tearing through everything that Sylvia Townsend Warner had written and directed me on Twitter to this to this book of letters, which first I checked out from the library and then actually went and bought because I could tell I was going to want to keep it.
John also read Maxwell weirdly.
Yes, it is strange. This is going to be a mostly William Maxwell segment, which is fine by me because I love him. It's funny, Tina, I've heard great things about that collection of letters. I actually own two other collections of letters of his. He was a very prolific letter writer. There's a collection of his letters to Eudora Welty called What There Is to Say We Have Said. And then he has a collection with Frank O'Connor called The Happiness of Getting It Down Right, which is, I think, it's been a while since I dipped into it, but it's sort of a bit more about like the craft, and they would, you know, send letters back and forth about the stories and editing them. I happened to read They Came Like Swallows, which is Maxwell's 1937 novel about the 1918 influenza epidemic. So you might understand why I finally decided to pick this one up. Because Maxwell is such a great subtle writer, it's not a very salacious look at the epidemic. It's kind of in the background a bit as this family's mother is sick. And you get some brief descriptions of the way that the town and the schools are dealing with the flu, which is really interesting given our current moment and how people are debating, you know, what should and shouldn't remain open. But those are just brief passages. Mainly, it's just a portrait of this family's life told in three sections. The first one is from the perspective of the 8-year-old son named Bunny. The second is from the perspective of a 13-year-old boy named Robert. And then the third is from their father. And they're all sort of third-person perspectives, but through their activities and lives. Yeah, I don't know what to say, except that Maxwell, I think, is a genius.
I think that's what we all have to say.
A very deceptively plain, but really elegant and emotionally powerful in an accumulative way writer. And So Long, See You Tomorrow, another short novel of his, is one of my favorite books. So I would recommend both of those. And then just because Pamela brought it up, it's funny hearing Dan on Maxwell. That's a great piece. The poet Edward Hirsch once wrote a piece about Maxwell and his relationship with him and his death. I'm actually going to read this paragraph because it's really beautiful and because it gets at some of what They Came Like Swallows is about too. He says, Maxwell's past was so immediate to him because there was such a clear before and after in his life, which was sundered in two by the death of his mother. Everything was fastened at a specific moment in time when his childhood was lost forever. That's when he discovered what he called, in a resonant phrase, the fragility of human happiness. I have the harrowing image of him as a 10-year-old boy pacing up and down the floor of an empty house at night with his father, both of them in bewildered mourning, in numb grief, unable to comfort each other. His fate was sealed on those nights. There's a telling moment near the end of So Long, See You Tomorrow when the narrator is talking to his psychiatrist about his mother's death. He means to say, I couldn't bear it, but what comes out of his mouth is, I can't bear it. And then he rushes into the city in tears. He says, New York City is a place where one can weep on the sidewalk in perfect privacy. There is something Maxwellian about inconsolable grief. The loss of his mother was so traumatic and intolerable for him that his memory, supplemented by imagination, set out to defy it. Hmm. And that's, you can find that online if you search for Edward Hirsch and William Maxwell. Pamela, what did you read recently?
Well, I'm actually going to talk about another genius. And I know that both of you are huge fans as well. He was a guest earlier on the podcast, Ayad Akhtar, whose new novel is Homeland Elegies. I just loved this book. You know, we've had a lot of conversation on the desk about, is it a novel? Is it not a novel? He says it's a novel. I think it's a novel. I think you both think it's a novel. Do you both think it's a novel?
I think it's a novel. I go back and forth. The first time I was reading it, I was not sure it was a novel, actually. Second time, I felt more confident it was a novel.
John?
I'm a bit less confident about that, but you know, it is what he says it is, and I do think it's a great book. So
I mean, I kind of love the idea that it can be a novel, that you could write a memoir essentially and then sort of rub out the things you want to rub out and change things and move around. I mean, it's interesting to me when you talk to journalists who become novelists. For me, it's like, you know, I don't know, a dentist becoming a bricklayer. Like, they're just different skills, even though they both involve the hands. One of the things people say is so freeing is that it's just amazing to be able to make things up, you know, that like you can't do that as a journalist, no matter what some people think. And, you know, sometimes you do as a reporter kind of wish, like, if only I could find this one person who would say X, or if only such and such were true. And I think that that's what happens with a novel, is that the journalist, you know, trying it out for the first time, or the nonfiction writer, is able to just make stuff up. My sense is that he may have started this as a memoir, but that he then realized, what if you turn it into fiction? What would that enable you to do? And I think it enabled him in this case, and I should say a little bit about the book, although he was on the podcast talking about it a couple of months ago. This is about his experience as, or his character's experience, as a Pakistani-American post 9/11, although the narrative goes back pre 9/11 and talks about other instances in which being a Muslim American is a challenging experience, both for him, and he's in his, I think, late 40s or early 50s, and for his parents and their generation who immigrated from Pakistan. And, you know, there's a lot in there that you kind of want to believe is true. For example, his father, who is a very successful cardiologist when the book opens, who specializes in particular heart syndrome, briefly for a few years, has Donald Trump as a patient. They become friends. Donald Trump sort of, I guess, indirectly changes the course of the father's life and his love life, his romantic and sex life, I guess, in particular. And that you kind of want to believe is 100% real, but who knows?
The basics of that are real, right?
I would like to say so, but I don't know. I would like to, yeah. I mean, and you know, and obviously this question has come up with memoir again and again and again, going back to James Fry. You know, I don't know how much of memoir, real memoir, straight memoir, is real anyway. How much do we remember? How much do we blur? And even in a memoir in which everything is strictly factual, it's always selective. There's always a mission. So what he said about writing this as a novel is that he wanted to blur reality in the same way that our current sort of politics and social media have blurred reality, that it's a kind of reality TV show of a book in a way, or it's trying to invoke that experience of not knowing what's real or not. And I mean, maybe our conversation makes clear that he succeeds certainly on those terms. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And I also, not that you're saying the opposite of this, but just for people who haven't read the book, reality TV for me has a very kind of two-dimensional, you know, I think it does have that feeling of what's true and what's not. And it's also his portraits of people, including his father and himself, are so well-rounded. And I think what I really appreciated most about the book is that in the current moment, both politically and just in media and everywhere, basically, when people turn people into caricatures for the sake of conflict or polarization, that he takes people's thoughts and experiences and really, in a novelistic way, I guess that's where it becomes most novelistic to me, gets inside of them and kind of gives you their motivations and their complexities without necessarily forgiving them. And I found that really brilliant.
I should say that by comparing it to reality TV, you don't have to be a reality TV fan to right. enjoy this book. I don't think I've seen a reality TV show since the premiere of, was it Survivor? What was the first one where they were all on an island?
Yeah, Survivor. And then
that's but Survivor.
You must have seen The Real World in the 90s on MTV, no?
No, I never did.
Oh,
I never
wow.
did. You know,
wow.
John, when MTV sort of abandoned videos, I was right. that was it for me.
Well, you were smart to abandon that.
Yeah.
All right. Let's run down the list of books we read. Tina?
I read The Element of Lavishness, the letters of Sylvia Townsend Warner and William Maxwell.
John?
I read William Maxwell's novel, They Came Like Swallows.
You're both making me want to read William Maxwell again, but what I read was Homeland Elegies, a novel by Ayad Akhtar. Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. And you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. I write back, not right away, but I do. The Book Review Podcast is produced by the great Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media, with a major assist from my colleague John Williams. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.